welcome to the Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month of July by the Justice Brothers, which we'll speak about in just a moment. Graham Goodwin, you might be the happiest guy I know right now, coming off of an amazing weekend of vintage sports car brilliance at the Circuit de la Sarthe at Le Mans. We're going to get into that. We had a really amazing, amazing event at Canadian Tire Motorsports Park with IMSA. We have the retirement announcement from Craig Lowndes to get into, and as usual, we have awesome questions to dive into as quickly as we can. The IMSA stuff is going to take us a little bit, so let's start with just pure joy. Tell us about being there for a couple of days with pretty much the fantasy list of sports cars, including many prototypes that are just all-time greats.
Stunning. Ninth time that we've had the Le Mans Classic. It's an event that takes place every 2 years. I think they need 2 years to actually come up with the entry list. Astonishing entry list of cars. Something like 700 cars on track over the three-day meeting with 1,000 drivers, including some amazing names. From 1920s all the way through, I think the most recent car we saw out at least demonstrating was maybe only a couple of years old. That's part of the Club Endurance Legends. But some amazing names. 10 previous Le Mans winning drivers involved on track during the meeting, including Henri Pescarolo, who demonstrated Pescarolo, I think possibly the first time he's driven the 01 at the Le Mans over the full track. Six age-banded grids called Plateau, each of which did 3 45-minute races apiece for a combined result, plus a Group C race, 40 cars on track for that, plus the Jaguar Challenge, 40 E-type Jags, plus C-types, D-types, and the Mark IIs and S-type Jaguar saloon cars, and a huge grid of period Porsches for a celebration, of course, of 70 years of that. On top of that, near 80 more recent sports GTs and prototypes for the Global Endurance Challenges introduction to the Le Mans circuit, with some astonishing cars in that grid, and beginning to now be made a little bit more clear as to what the plans are for that grid moving forward. We are certainly going to be seeing more of these modern classics. Amazing weekend. 135,000 people, we are told, paid to come through the gates. Temperatures 30 degrees plus for most of it. So it's a little too warm for my kind of taste, it has to be said. But a fantastic week of classic racing, some fantastic chatter in the background, news still to emerge from some of those conversations. But boy, you'd have loved it. You'd have loved it, MP. It's right up your street.
And what is that sound I hear? Is it a twin turbo V8 of the 3.6 liter variety in a Toyota GT1? Yes, it is. Thanks to you organizing that, mate, and getting a audio recorder into the just stunning 1999 Toyota GT1, the only one free from captivity. So, yeah, thank you for that gift, and I hope that that is up on dailysportscar.com right now for folks to ride along in that just true gem.
Well, there will be, I'm sure, many, many more of those to come. Lots of interest in what we're doing, what you're doing in particular, MP, from a number of people with very, very interesting cars. So watch this space for some more collaboration with some of those amazing modern classics. We had a couple of near misses, a couple of cars that I'm afraid failed underneath us while the recorder was aboard, and at least one occasion, I'm afraid, me with a bit of finger trouble not pressing the record button properly. But there will be many, many more to come in the coming weeks and months. But for now, you know, guys out there, if you're listening and you're looking for, you know, a classic event to put on your calendars, Le Mans Classic 2020, it's an absolute must-have. I spent a glorious morning on Friday sitting trackside for the first time in 20 years at Le Mans for any kind of significant period of time. Normally, you know, our time is spent either in a TV or a radio studio or in the press room. But I will tell you this, one astounding coincidence. standing by the GT1 as we were putting the recorder aboard, was tapped on the shoulder by a fan, car fan, asked if I was Graham Goodwin. Yes, I am. Said, loved listening to the podcast. So, Andy, thank you very much for that one. We're chatting away, and I mentioned to him that actually a piece of bodywork from a Toyota GT1, I'm looking at it right now in the office, mounted on the wall from the number two car, destroyed in the hands of Thierry Boutsen, career-ending accident for Thierry, damaged his back in that accident. We're chatting away about this, and the guy just had that look on his face to say, you weren't there with your little lad, were you? Yes, I was. And it turns out from 1999, nearly 20 years ago, this gentleman was sitting behind us on the bus all the way to Le Mans and back. Absolutely astounding stuff. So, yeah, what goes around comes around.
I mean, the thing that I take away from this event, Graham, with the crowd size that you mentioned, that dwarfs just about every single motor racing event, normal motor racing event that I can think of. I mean, and this is not, you know, no disrespect to IMSA, but that's a larger crowd for a vintage racing event involving sports cars than anything that will be seen at the Rolex 24 at Daytona, Sebring, you name it. And so I think it just speaks to the fact, if we want to carry over what we have just seen happen in France, that there's an appetite. There's a really strong appetite for folks who want to enjoy the past along with the present. And, you know, with all that said, the more this were to happen, I think, at whether it's Pirelli World Challenge, IMSA, ELMS, Blancpain, I don't care what it is, Australian supercars, I think just continuing to marry the past with the present is going to be a way for any series, any track, honestly, to continue to grow their numbers, as I struggle to speak words out of my mouth, which is, you know, a topic that we frequently labor over.
Completely agree. I mean, the reality is this was pure car passion. The noise, the sound, the looks of it, some of the drivers, an absolute delight. To catch up with a long chat with Romain Dumas, who was there with Porsche, racing and demonstrating a number of beautiful cars. We had a couple of nasty accidents. Thankfully, nobody hurt. One story has actually come up with some of the questions, so we'll leave it for that about the 917 that John Wolfe was aboard when he was killed back in 1969. That car rebuilt and racing for the very first time since then. And all I can say is its racing history didn't get much better, I'm afraid. But you name it, there was an example of it there. There were cars there, race cars and road cars, some of which I've never seen before, some of which I was delighted to see again. And that lasted all the way back to the queue to get off the ferry at Portsmouth, when for the first time ever, one of my unicorn cars, the Jensen FF, the first production four-wheel drive car, the first production car with anti-lock brakes, looks like a Jensen Interceptor, isn't parked up alongside us for a couple of glorious minutes as we waited for passport control. It was just a weekend to die for. Absolutely fantastic. And next time around, MP, we'll have to wait and see whether or not we can get it on your calendar.
I'm going to buy a little boat, start rowing. Hopefully I'll be there in time if I don't sink before getting there. Let's move on to IMSA at Canadian Tire Motorsports Park, also known as Mosport. Before we do that, though, let's give some thanks to our friends at Justice Brothers, who have come on board for the month of July to support our Marshall Pruitt podcast here. They are very much an American institution, Graham, and I know that their products aren't limited to the U.S., but their additives, lubricants, and cleaners are definitely America's brand for quality. They're also heavily involved in motor racing and have been. That's when I first got to know them. My very first day as a gopher, working on my first ever team, which happened to be a pro racing team in 1986, they happened to be distributors for the Justice Brothers and were huge. I mean, that was actually the team's primary business, which was selling, distributing JB Products, and that's another thing that they're looking to do here, hoping to connect with folks through our podcast, getting them to visit justicebrothers.com if you have an interest in becoming part of their sales and distribution team. Definitely a company that, rather than hiring a huge sales force, invites folks to come on board and become independent distributors. So if you're interested in that, the either automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, or industrial markets, go ahead and take a look at justicebrothers.com, and they might have something for you. Speaking of having something for everybody, the Core Autosport team did the rather rare, I think never done before feat, Graham, at CTMP, and that was between their prototype team and the Porsche GT team, which Core Autosport runs on the German manufacturer's behalf. They led 8 consecutive sessions. They led everything on Friday, Saturday morning warm-up, and were on pole in both prototype and GTLM come qualifying on Saturday. So that's 4 sessions blanked by Core in prototype, and that's also 4 sessions blanked by the Core-facilitated Porsche GT team in GTLM. Then we obviously had Colin Brown and John Bennett go on to win the race overall. Second consecutive overall victory for the Spec WEC LMP2 chassis. Obviously, they were unable to win in GTLM, Graham. That was taken by masterful timing on pit stops for the Ford Chip Ganassi GT effort there. But if we're talking about a team that showed the world how good it was, how good its drivers were, engineers, crew, you name it, I would say Canada was Core's event.
Well, I mean, they showed signs, didn't they, of pulling it all together at Watkins Glen just a week or so ago. This time it all fell into place. They played the same game again, did they not? Setting pole position, then opting to cede that in lieu of a tactical run to put John Bennett in the car, to start the race and keep him out of trouble. But it came together this time. Colin Brown, no Romain Dumas, of course. He was my side of the Atlantic this time, but Romain not needed for the shorter race format. Fault the stuff.
We look at what took place there. I wasn't sure this strategy was going to work out in their favor in the same way that it did at Watkins Glen, Graham, where Colin was obviously quick like a bunny in qualifying. They chose to start John Bennett, obviously had Romain Dumas in the car. With 6 hours, being able to minimize the pro-am pace of John in a class filled with essentially nothing but pro talent, you could do that. Colin, Romain, 6 hours, that strategy was always going to play to their favor. A 2-hour 40-minute event, though, minus Romain, with Colin on pole, climbing out so that John could start, which moved the car to the back of the field, back of the prototype field, I should say, not the full field. Certainly concerned that John's, again, and we're not saying anything negative about John, but the fact that he is not a pro driver, definitely concerned that the amount of time he would forfeit during his 30-ish minutes in the car, which is the minimum drive time required to score points, weren't sure if that was going to be something that would allow Colin to overcome that deficit. Well, you sprinkle in a bunch of yellows. There was a lot of poor decision-making, driving-wise, Graham, parts and pieces falling off cars. There are a lot of yellows that helped either pack up the field or overcome some of the track deficit in terms of where Colin happened to be sitting. Definitely helped there with track position. And then you just throw in some crazy, crazy speed demonstrated by the young lad, plus the fact that IMSA has gotten its, all right, first usage here, balance of performance to a place where on these smooth flowing tracks, the DPI field is definitely a little bit underwhelming compared to the fastest WEC P2s. Kind of perfect circumstances to turn what I thought was going to be a gamble that didn't pay off into something where he was able to pass Jordan Taylor for the win with 8 minutes to go. Just a thrilling, thrilling thing, Graham, that I think if folks go back and just kind of isolate watching the prototype portion of the broadcast, you realize that, whoa, this was magic, just true magic on display.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's what people want to see from endurance racing. You remember the conversations we had around Le Mans and the shortcomings of that race. That, you know, I wouldn't like it to go forward by people believing that what I saw directly just a few weeks later at Watkins Glen was faultless. It wasn't. There are some questions to answer around the way in which, for instance, some of the officiating falls out in IMSA racing, particularly with the longer races. But what people want is they want to see these cars driven hard. They want to see these cars driven hard for a long time, and they want to see the team play a full part, not just the drivers, the team. And if we can get to the stage where you've got that mix of the cars, the drivers, the teams and the officiating coming together, this can be. We know that when that comes together, it is simply an unbeatable display of motorsport. And that's, I think, what CORE actually managed to get on the board in Canadian Tire Motorsport Park.
We also have what we trailed a little bit, a GTLM outcome that I thought was going to be less than linear once the green flag wave, Graham. I really did think that the Porsches, with their just sheer pace and qualifying, barring something really odd happening, I thought they were just going to run away with things. And that wasn't exactly the case. I mean, they did lead a considerable amount of the event through a little bit of pit stop timing. We had the BMWs, which were very quick in demonstrating that they were capable of setting some fairly fast lap times while leading as well. And we had at least the initial kind of fallback at the start among the Fords, but then crept forward. Ryan Briscoe definitely drove the wheels off of the entry. And then Westy, when he climbed in, as we have waxed on many times before, there are few better at driving a sports car than Richard Westbrook. And Westy just went to town on getting that car towards the front, was leading when the caution that they needed happened to fall, was at the right spot on the track for the team to call him in, just made it in before IMSA threw the yellow, which would have closed the pits, but was able to sneak in, get the fuel that they needed, get the tires that they needed to get to the finish in a legal manner, and was able to go on and win the race. If I thought that prototype was not a strategy that was going to work out for CORE and was wrong, I was also completely wrong with GTLM, Graham. I thought this was going to be Porsche celebrating, and man, I think the Ford team also felt a little bit like, ooh, we just this is found money on the ground. Let's pick it up and run.
Well, again, it just shows, doesn't it, much as we can moan, groan, and other unpleasant words about balance of performance, the reality is that the competition is remarkably close, and any single opportunity is going to be, well, in UK terms, we'd say a rat on a chip, a fry, I think we'll say for your North American buddies over there. But these guys, it's remorseless of all the classes in world motorsport at the moment. GT racing in general, GTLM, GTE in particular, it's so close. And all that any of these guys need in what's a stellar lineup in every single one of the championships where these cars are actually out to play in factory-backed garb. You know, these guys will just take anything that they'll will be offered. If they're just marginally off on pace, if there's been a minor issue, whatever it is, you're going to find the likes of Richard Westbrook et al. Just taking any opportunity to come home for, well, clearly a championship and race wins that properly matter to them and more important for their continued employ, their employers.
Other topic for us to hit, obviously, is the remaining class in GT Daytona. I saw that IMSA, after the event, put out a bit of a wrap-up and some other comments and such about how happy they were and impressed they were with the parity in the classy parity. That's a nice way of escaping the second use of BOP. What I took away was an opinion and a feeling that was very much the same, you could say, looking at how I thought, at least, the GTD class was a very close run affair. loved the surprised aspect of this too, though, Graham. And that's why I think I was just so elated for how Canada and the trip for IMSA and their WeatherTech Sports Car Championship went. Two events in a row, frankly, between Watkins Glen and CTMP, where if you're writing headlines, or you're hoping for things to really just give the series more momentum, positive stuff that has happened, this is an event where I look at and say, okay, GTD went down in another way with a victory for young Mr. Jaron Bleekemolen, and also with our friend Ben Keating, where the door wasn't necessarily open. There was a bit of a mistake on a restart by Kyle Marcelli leading GTD for the 3GT Lexus program at his home event in Canada. Got wide coming out of the final corner on the restart. That gave Jaron the hole to go through. Took the lead, got the win. Up till that point, looked like 3GT would be transferring their pole into a win, but a little mistake, some pressure late in the event, Graham, and you know, like a Westbrook, like an anybody that we just bow to and say, you're amazing. You give Jaron the slightest opportunity, that guy's going right to the front, and he's not giving it up. That's exactly what we had here. And, man, when you see the big smile on Ben Keating's face after a victory that, you know, maybe they weren't counting on in the latter stages, also another thing to cheer for.
Absolutely. And astoundingly, what, six races for GTD now in the 2018 season, six different winners in those races, despite the fact that we've seen a number of teams in pretty dominant form. That variety continues to show itself at the top of the lead of the order at the end of these races. 3GT just do seem to have a talent for just not converting what looks like race-winning pace into the ultimate results, don't they? And the Riley Motorsport crew, well, that's, I suspect, what they needed after what looks like it's been a difficult week or so, with the Sun Energy One guys moving away from Riley. The second car that they've been running so far this season will not be playing a part with Riley anymore in 2018. We wait to see whether or not we're going to see that car back.
So with all that said, would also just give great thanks and respect to the track there at CTMP for continuing to put on a really awesome event, and also to one of IMSA's biggest crowds and most enthusiastic crowds that it comes across throughout the entire year. So just yet again, another celebration that makes me think, like I mentioned on the Week in IndyCar podcast after Road America, that I thought the fan base was strong enough and passionate enough that IndyCar could consider having two rounds there per year, and they would be aptly supported and have plenty of folks turn out wanting to see two rounds there. I'm feeling the same way, Graham, about CTMP. You know, the comment that everybody makes, how passionate that Canadian motorsports fans are. We've known that forever, but I look at that event and just say, boy, I bet you they could hold two, and each one would look just completely filled out with folks loving what they have. So it's just hard not to feel good about the series and about the sport when you see that kind of turnout and support, knowing that we're going to go to a not that many, but we'll go to a few more events this year where it's half full, three quarters full. And anytime you can pack the house, I say, let's go there twice because I'm stupid in the head.
Well, you know what? It's another big old school track, and the fans do like to come to those old school tracks. Happily, we had none of the trouble we expected with the bear attacks that were kept away this year.
Yes, thankfully.
I am hearing there was a nasty little, well, gnawing from a beaver that I've heard reported from one of the campsites, but that's been kept quiet, I suspect, by the PR team, just in case that draws people away for future. But bear attacks, there were none. So that's one we can be thankful for. CTMP, though, must bought in old money. You know, we need more of these, not fewer, to sports. That's what we need.
Just looking at a final few things to clean up or take care of before we leave Canada and head to Craig Lowndes and then move on to Q&A. We did see that there was some very nice inter-class helping between a prototype and a GTD car, making sure that the brakes worked on one particular prototype.
Yes.
Graham, you want to share with folks who might not have seen the footage, that the sideways footage that was posted, what happened there?
Yeah, it looks like Bill Oberlin had his head out the window because, yes, Bill, it was, aboard the 96 Turner car that won last time out, said that misunderstanding had held up. It was your mate Juan Pablo Montoya, I'm afraid.
It is what it is.
And he was held up for a couple of corners, clearly wasn't very happy about that, and finally made his way by the GTD BMW, at which point he employed tactics on Bill Oberlin, which were very reminiscent of those of his countrymen on the football field during the World Cup just a few days ago. They're on the way home. He isn't. But a couple of brake tests from Juan Pablo. Not smart. Juan Pablo, come on, play nice. But Bill Oberlin showing exactly what was happening from his perspective. Should say, by the way, thoughts with the performance tech team after their car comprehensively deconstructed in practice and not taking part in the race. And your mate Sergio Castroneves did an almost similar thing, did he not, later in the meeting?
Yeah, there was there were plenty of mistakes that took place. There was, and there's a couple questions we have on some of the driving standards and or incidents that were either penalized or not penalized. So we'll save those for Q&A. There's a lot of spare parts to use, I can tell you that. There's a lot of work going on in GTD. John Potter had a crash, said that there was some sort of electrical failure heading in. Moss Corner was, I think, that general region was the number one place for contact and bad accidents to happen throughout the event. Let's look at points a little bit here, Graham. We had with the outcome that we had, with the core team winning, the Wayne Taylor Cadillac coming second, the 31 Action Express third, and the 5 Action Express Cadillac fourth. We had a slight shift atop the prototype championship with the 31, the Verrett Kierlin and Felipe Nasr. 1 point now, 1 point lead, moving ahead of Felipe Albuquerque in the sister number 5 entry, with Joao Barbosa out due to injury for a little bit. He's obviously no longer paired in the championship hunt with Felipe, so he is there on an island in second. And we have in third Jordan Taylor and Renger van de Zande. So despite the fact that we have had some really strong performances of late by WEC P2 entries, which has now elevated the core entry of Colin Brown and John Bennett to fourth overall, we still have three Cadillacs sitting firmly atop prototype, despite the fact that while they haven't been winning a ton lately, we can see that they have been very solid, picking up points wherever they happen to go. The other thing that I found, well, I shouldn't say other thing, but one other point that definitely stands out to me from an interest is looking at, Graham, how if we go down to GTD, before we get to GTLM, this has been a highly competitive year, as you mentioned. We've had a lot of different winners in that class, a lot of really cool things taking place there. That being said, we still have, and this is to their massive credit, the Paul Miller Racing Team, the Lamborghini Huracan GT3 entry with Brian Sellers and Madison Snow. They have been, they have been earning points at an impressive clip. And I can't remember in GTD, Graham, where we've had a team like this that has been so strong and consistent in the points. Still have Catherine Legg on an island as well in second, 3 points behind the Paul Miller team in her Meyer Shank Acura. And then now with their win, Ben Keating and Jaron Bleekemolen are inching even closer now. They're holding third. So some definite fun there. But to the PMR Lamborghini team, been really impressive to see them going about their work this year in a way that speaks to a championship mindset. But then also atop GT Le Mans, Graham, we have the most recent race winners with the Ganassi 67 entry with Westy and Briscoe, 6 points over Antonio Garcia and Ian Magnussen in their Corvette. The two Corvettes Did a bit of a little bit of a locomotive run late in the race, Graham, to take second and third. So good on them. And then third overall in the standings, we have the sister Ford of Dirk Mueller and Joey Hand, and a Corvette right behind them in Ollie Gavin and Tommy Milner. So it is America, 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 and America, 1 through 4 in GTLM, even though half of those cars are built in Canada. So North America, I should say. We should be super proud here. And then Porsche's Earl Bamber and Lawrence Vanthoor, part of a very close pack, along with Nick Tandy and Patrick Pile. Believe it or not, Graham, from Ollie Gavin and Tommy Milner down to the next Porsche, they are either equal or separated by a single point. So,
yeah,
a lot of points.
GTLM, you've got the Fords and the Corvettes making America great. That's G-R-E-A-T again, from their point of view, and G-R-A-T-E from the point of view of the rest of them.
Absolutely. Let's jump to our last topic of conversation before moving on to questions. And that's our man Craig Lowndes. Love that guy. 44 years old, has achieved, I mean, hard to contextualize how much he has achieved in his career, but I would say even more, and we'll get to this in one question or one comment that came in from a friend in Australia, what he means to Australian motorsports and what he has meant for how long or for so long, announcing that he will be calling time on his full-time career at the end of the current Australian Supercars Championship. Graham, this is someone who has, you know, been a standout in Formula 3000, didn't get to Formula 1, but this is just one of the world's genuine elite drivers who I think that since he has spent most of his career competing at home down under, his true brilliance is something that far too many people have not been able to see and appreciate on their own.
Well, it's not just on track. I mean, the pleasure, first time I met Craig was, oddly enough, at the Spa 24 Hours. And he was a revelation. Very often, elite sportsmen, well-polished in terms of the way they'll deal with media, particularly media they don't know, well-polished, but maybe at times somewhat vanilla. Not Mr. Lowndes. Mr. Lowndes, one of the great interviews for any journalist that happens to point their recorder or their pad and pen in his direction. I know there's going to be some questions to come about what might come next. We'll leave those to one side. Whatever it is, I hope our paths intersect again, because every time I've seen him behind the wheel of anything, he's put his all into it. His all is very often good enough. And then when he gets out, what an ambassador for the sport. And we've not got enough of them. So I'm hoping whatever comes next, it means we're going to be seeing a lot more of him, and particularly on track somewhere. And I suspect that we may very well do that.
I shot Craig a text. I haven't heard back from him yet, knowing that essentially he's waking up right around when my work day is ending. But I know that at least in the past, and I don't mind mentioning this because it didn't come to fruition, but I was trying to help him a couple years ago with some opportunities, or at least, you know, some folks to speak with here in North America to come and do the Rolex 24 Daytona Mobile 1 12 Hours of Sebring. And I hope if there is a desire, interest for him as he moves to a part-time pick and choose what he wants to do phase of his career next year. Yeah, if there's anything there for him, I'd love to point him in whatever directions, because having Craig over here for some of IMSA's big endurance races, or I'm sure any of, you know, the WEC, ELMS, just a pleasure of a person, someone with just a great warmth and enthusiasm. That, as you found, Graham, someone who's in his 40s, been doing this his entire career, you don't always get that big spark. You don't always get that sheer joy with someone who is that far into their career. And of the many things I've appreciated about Craig, it's that you, if you hadn't seen him, if you were just speaking with him by phone or otherwise, you could easily be confused that he was 25 years old and at the early part of his career, because that's the kind of enthusiasm that he maintains. So I think one of the many reasons why he has become such a beloved part of Australian motorsport. Well, Should we get into questions? Oh, we've got questions. We've got plenty of them. So you think we should dive in here at this point, my man?
I think we should go for it. I think we should love this bit.
All right. Well, I've got some questions here, staring at this lovely cartoon done of us by our friend Roger Warwick. Tim,
well,
saying,
I'm looking at Twitter. If you're looking at Facebook,
okay,
so that helps.
Good. Tim, same from Australia. What's your dream resto mod or fantasy race car build? Ideally, from a car that didn't race in a given series that could or should have. He says mine, and this is something, dear listeners, we continue to love and would love more of. Not just asking questions, but sharing your own thoughts, your own passions, your own commentary on something, whatever it is. Please share that with us, because we'd love to include it. Tim says his currently is a Toyota Supra RZ, built as a 1990s and 2000 Trans Am race car with a standard 2JZ motor, but modified for 700 to 800 horsepower. Tim, good man.
Wow.
The Supra thing is actually something I did want to talk about and kind of forgot until he mentioned it. So let's answer Tim's question, and then let's kind of pull in one other topic before we get on to more questions. But if you had to build a fantasy Graham Goodwin, either resto mod or fantasy car, something that maybe didn't race in a specific series, what comes to mind?
I think I would go for the Nissan GT-R LM with a package that worked, is the honest answer, because I'd just love to see whether or not the aero concept had any possibility of working. As it turned out, I think our friends at Nissan Nismo placed way too much faith in the package they determined was the optimum one, way beyond the point where they should have decided, actually, no, this isn't going to work, let's try again. I'd like them to you know, in a ideal world, an opportunity to see whether, with a package under the bonnet of that thing, just whether or not they could have produced the goods. Loads more beyond that. There's lots and lots of cars that's, you know, race poorly or not at all in period that, you know, I'd like another team, another engineering team to take a look at to see whether or not they could have fulfilled promise. But that's the one. That's the one that when you first saw it, you were with me when we first saw the plans for that car, MP. And it was one of those moments where I don't know what you thought. I thought that's either going to be terrible or absolutely groundbreaking. And we genuinely came out from that meeting having not a clue which one it was going to be.
I was so hopeful, yeah, and that entire project was killed by the really, really unfortunate decision to go with the Toro Track ERS system, kinetic ERS, truly mechanical kinetic ERS system. Yeah, that thing killed the whole thing, but the potential is there. Boy, yeah, I'm with you. I would have loved to have seen that, but granted, I guess effectively the answer would be to rebuild that car or redo that car properly. Mine, Tim, and I have actually, I had this dream around in the early, I guess, mid-2000s, worked with a friend here in California and built a Subaru WRX STI that we did turn up for two World Challenge rounds in the GT category and failed miserably. I was largely, this is one of the, a couple of things that told me, Pruitt, you need to hang it up on that part of your career, but around that time, this is when the World Challenge Series was letting folks kind of bring in whatever you wanted. This is when the Cadillacs came in and they let them channel and chop them, these production cars, into things that, you know, looked nothing like they did coming off the showroom floor. I had a dream, Tim, at this time to do that same kind of craziness with the Dodge Magnum, which was kind of a big brawler V8 bread van estate looking vehicle. And I figured it's big and crazy. It has a large motor that I know that we could, you know, get 600 plus horsepower out of. And I love the fact that it wasn't just a traditional sedan or supercar. It was this big, like, you know, satanic Dodge looking thing. So I had dreams of doing a similar Cadillac channel and chop, lower the heck out of it, and have this race car where you could put your groceries in the back and also go beat everybody in Pirelli World Challenge Series events. It was purely a dream. Never had any, there was no real chance of it happening, but that was my dream, Tim. And thanks for starting off the show with just a fun little bit of a sideways question. But let's come back to the thing that I forgot about, Graham, and that was Toyota announcing that starting next year in their mid-tier category, they will be using the Supra name and also a body that looks NASCAR-y, Supra-ish, I guess. But they will be bringing the Toyota Supra name to NASCAR. I just posted that story written by my colleague at Racer, Kelly Crandall, on Twitter and Facebook, and wrote as much as I could, which was, I'm at a loss for words. And because I didn't explain myself, a lot of folks, rightfully so, thought I was just referring to the looks. It had nothing to do with the looks. It had everything to do, though, Graham, as someone who's been a lifelong fan of Japanese cars, JDM machinery. For me, at least, the Supra model, and specifically the Supra name, brother, that is legendary status. That's something that I associate with peak performance on the tuner side, both drag racing and road racing, the amount of power that's been made with the inline sixes models from the 80s and 90s, in particular, 1,000 plus horsepower with ease. I just think big performance, holy cow. Also, medium to high tech, possibly. Slapping the Supra name on a kind of vanilla looking body in some low-tech V8 roundy-round series. I just thought the use of the Toyota name in that environment was beyond sacrilegious. So that's why I had that reaction of, like, I'm at a loss for words. Yeah, this is like, well, I can't even come up with a parallel of another car, but it's the same reason why, how's this? I think folks would react the same if they saw 911 on the side of a stock car, and you go, wait a minute. How in the world can you take all the history of a 911 and try and slap it on to this kind of template-based stock car type thing? That's why I reacted that way to seeing Supra as the new endeavor here starting in 2019. How did this land for you?
It looks to me like somebody has hit it with the ugly stick until they ran out of NG. And that's not what a Supra should look like. I like you, I have to say, from afar with the early Supras that came over here to the UK and through to the cars we've seen until really quite recently. Probably made most famous for the current era audience through the Fast and Furious movies, that last Supra, and of course now the concept that we're seeing come to fruition for the next generation. It just, to be honest with you, lazy. It just strikes me as lazy. It strikes me as being an utterly pointless endeavour to bring relevance to a format where there is just zero relevance to that car. And I looked at it and was sad.
Jordan Hopwood says, I used to understand the need for GTE and GT3 being two different classes, GTE having technical regulations, GT3 being a run whatever you brung, and it will be balanced type affair. However, with GTE being so heavily based on balance of performance now, what is the point? Also, why does it seem that the SRO's GT3 BOP is a lot more balanced and more even than GTE's BOP? This is BOP and GTE always seems to be falling in favor of different manufacturers, race to race. That's some great recognition and commentary there, Jordan. One that Graham and I touched on certainly throughout, during, and after 24 Hours of Le Mans, where there were manufacturers in GTE asking the same thing. What do you think, Graham, in terms of what I would say is the most prescient point here of why does it seem like the SRO with their GT3 BOP tends to be maybe a little bit sharper from a consistency standpoint?
Well, first and foremost, I think on the GTLM and GTE Pro, I think it needs another look. That's before we go any further. I think they need to take two steps away from where we are and decide whether or not that's heading in a direction we want to go for that that class. Certainly, the factories are still interested in keeping that differentiation between GT3 and GTLM cars. But going on to SRO, quite correct. They have a very good, well-proven form of balanced performance put together by a team that's got matchless experience in doing it. However, it's not perfect. It's far, far, far from perfect. And there is always the opportunity for the likes of you and me, Marshall, and the likes of the fan base out there and our listeners and our readers for the various journals we contribute to find fault, and they do, and often there are good reasons for it. I'll give you just one example. I think we've referred to it before, which is if we are led to believe that all are equal over a particular season in GT3 and fairly equal at any given circuit, then you do then need to look at some of the individual performances therein. And I came back this weekend chatting away to someone who asked a not dissimilar question to the events of Silverstone for the Blancpain Endurance Series. This was the first opportunity I had to see the brand new Bentley Continental in action, and it's fair to say the Team M Sport Bentley had a mare of the qualifying and race day, or the early part of race day, with one car starting from the back of the grid and the other car starting from pit lane. Those two cars finished, from memory, certainly mid-20s and 14th. Now, I know that professional GT drivers are of superhuman abilities, but they're not that superhuman. How did a car that is supposed to have a balance of performance manage to pass 36 other cars on track? That is not a balance of performance. That's a mistake.
And another great aspect added to the topic by Graham Goodwin. All right, I'm going to grab a couple here on Facebook before we shift over to Twitter and then come back to Facebook. And we also know that you have some family duties coming up.
Absolutely. I've got a Mrs. Goodwin to go and collect.
Absolutely. And this is also fitting our somewhat recent shift and dedication to try and do hour to hour and a half week in sports cars. Would also mention, because I asked for the same feedback on our week in IndyCar podcast. I just finished recording with Lee Diffie. We also get a fair amount of feedback, Graham, from folks saying thanks for the long podcast. It really helps. I'm either, you know, have a long drive every day, or, you know, the commute based stuff, whatever it is, I go on my long bike rides. And so we're going to try and keep things shorter than longer in most instances going forward. But if there are those of you who really, truly want the longer form, the thing I floated as a possibility while speaking with Lee was it wouldn't be impossible for you and I to kind of do an overtime version.
Oh,
which
no.
Is kind of a second one where if we want to do maybe another half hour, hour, usually just questions, because we always have far more questions that we can get to. Maybe that could be a second download so that you have options there. So anyways, if you have particular leanings one way or the other, shoot us a note on the Facebooks or the Tweeters or the whatever it is. And we will use all that to try and make some decisions that meet your needs going forward. All right. Going to take a couple here. First one, actually the very first question we received from Chuck Knob, said Townsend Bell commented on the IndyCar broadcast about Colin Brown rumored for an IndyCar test. Any information? No. Been meaning to catch up with Colin since yesterday. He and the core team are actually testing at Road America right now. So I think actually, Graham, probably shortly after we get done recording here, I will catch up with Colin. I know that there's an interest on Colin's behalf to get in the door somehow in IndyCar. And as Lee and I discussed, I think he's demonstrated everything one would need to, based on pure speed, experience, success, that for those in IndyCar who might be looking for the next Robert Wickens surprise. Hey, this guy came out of left field, maybe even Sports Cars, which is the same place that Wickens was plucked from. I think Colin might be among the leading choices there. But Chuck, as of right now, don't have an answer for you, but hopefully we'll have a story up here shortly, maybe even tomorrow, Wednesday, with our man, young Mr. Brown.
One thing you could say, though, of course, all he can do is go out there and win and go out there and beat the established talents from IndyCar in the very recent past. And of course, that's exactly what he's been doing. And the arrival of Penske in IMSA is allowing him and several other young guns to do exactly that. That's another exciting part of it.
Absolutely. Let's see. Thomas Pendergrass says, the timing of safety cars at CTMP seem to cause a lot of issues with cars entering a closed pit. What is the reason for penalizing a car for pitting under yellow, since they have to rejoin the safety car train at the back anyways? Well, this is part of the ongoing fun, Thomas, that we discuss. Sports car racing, I'm fully convinced, was never conceived as a sport. I'm 100% of the belief it was created as a rule-following exercise that happens to have vehicles and drivers involved. IMSA, over the years, and I'm not trying to single them out, but the question is about IMSA, but, you know, IMSA's rules over the years, they've been rewritten. There's been different folks in charge atop the series, and this is going back to the ALMS, its predecessor as well, even Grand Am. You get personalities and mindsets of the folks in charge that then play out or are demonstrated when you read through the rule book. Meaning, some folks are a little bit more lenient, and the rules that they pen or that they adjust reflect that. Others are super black and white, dang it, follow every single letter of the law. Rules reflect that as well. And so IMSA, at times, has had things where if you are, say, you have some sort of thing you've run afoul of with a rule, maybe to start the race, if you're late to grid, or if you are stuck on pit lane for the start, or again, we can pick a couple different things, but something where the problem is already the penalty, right? You've lost a lap or whatever it is, but the issue you had, it would be deemed by many to be enough of a, quote, penalty. Well, but then there's a penalty because you did whatever that thing was that was wrong. So you essentially get pinged twice and have to pay, you know, a penalty that was through misfortune or error, and then one that you ran afoul of in the rule book. I think with this, though, your question about, you know, folks pitting under yellow, or I should say when the pits are closed, the whole mindset here is there's no penalty if you happen to go through pit entry while the pits are closed and just keep motoring down pit lane and come out. You're obviously going to lose track position. But the issue is when folks pit while the pits are closed and receive full service. Not talking about someone with a blown tire getting it replaced. Not talking about a car running on fumes, Graham, where they're allowed to put in a quick splash just to keep going until the pits open back up. But, you know, if you're able to ignore the pits being closed, essentially be the only person on pit lane getting full fuel, getting fresh tires, come back out while the rest of the field is waiting to do that the following lap, you then, in theory, move to the front of the field when everyone else clears off to go in and do their pitting. So, again, trying to read a little bit between the question being asked and what I think the intent of what is being asked, but I have no problem with drivers being penalized for stopping and receiving service, full service, during closed pits. But again, if folks do realize that they have pitted and gone through that while things were closed and still done it, penalize them. If they've recognized it and just driven straight through, well, they paid their own penalty right there. I don't know if I'm recalling, though, Thomas, a second penalty for just simply driving through pit lane when it was closed. So if that's something you saw or something that I missed, then please hit us with another question for next week's episode.
I think the other thing to say in that regard is this. There are several intentions around the timing and the reality of what you do about bringing your field under caution. One of them, the main one, is of course about safety. It is about making sure that the competitor that might be in trouble, the course workers, then the intervention teams that are there to assist them, and indeed the other runners, are going to be safe. Pits generally are opened when the race director is satisfied that he has the field under control. If actually what you've got is a bit of a melee, that rather defeats that object. And you're absolutely right. There is the issue about the competitive advantage. There's the issue about it just being safe to do so. And I think the way that it's regarded is one extra lap under caution to make sure that can happen is a risk worth. Sorry, it's a risk worth taking in terms of the way in which the race pans out. So, yeah, lots of reasons behind it. Is there a perfect system out there? My guess is there are more perfect systems than the ones that most championships that we cover are currently using, and it's probably a hybrid of a number of systems that have been used by a number of different championships in a number of different ways.
All right, I'm going to knock out a few more quick ones here and then have a question for you to answer before we jump over to Twitter. Nicole Bitzer says, in regards to Catherine Legg, as we noted, sitting P2 in the GTD Championship with Marshank Racing, she says she is doing pretty good this year. Will she finish out the season? I hope so. I don't have an answer for you, Nicole. I still need to check in with Michael Shank, but I have to believe a way will be found, since we have reached a stage of the season where we don't have that many races left. Knowing how important she is to the MSR team, to Acura, to IMSA, to women in general in motor racing, I would say I would be shocked if her entry was not on the grid for the remaining races, but I'm still hoping to get complete clarity from Michael Shank on that. Let's see. We also have one here from Adam Bowman with rumors about a new Viper with a supercharged V8. What are the rules regarding other types of forced induction beyond turbochargers in both IMSA and the ACO rules? I got to admit, Adam, I haven't read with any kind of specifics in that area. I don't believe supercharging is illegal, at least on the IMSA side. I could be 1,000% wrong. Maybe that is included and I missed it, but I think turbocharging has become really the de facto form of forced induction, not only because it's easy, but if I'm just thinking from a rules and a regulation standpoint, it's the method that all major championships, sports car and some open wheel, have learned how to either regulate or monitor to a point to where they are happy that they can keep tabs on what is happening there.
We have had supercharged GT cars in the relatively recent past. And what I'm trying to think, definitely the original Jaguar XKR GT3 had a supercharger, one that Richard Lloyd et al. Put together. I think that's not the only one. I think we've had others as well. I've got a funny feeling we had a supercharged Lotus Elise GT3 back in the early days, one that was nationally homologated and was backed by the factory. But I believe they can be accommodated by the current rule set.
Doug Bonham, IMSA question. Did IMSA finally get the WEC P2/DPI balance of performance correct? Job done? Or did these tracks suit the global cars better? Doug, you definitely pointed out the number one thing that helped the WEC P2s move into two straight wins, and the fact that the next event we are going to is Road America, another high-speed flowing track where the top end and also the cornering capabilities of these cars. Granted, we'll always have to see what happens during the race, who gets taken out, mistakes, errors, whatever, but this is absolutely ripe. This looks like we could have a 3-for-3 on the WEC P2 front. Try not to get into too much of past conversations we've had many times on the podcast here, Doug. I will mention, just briefly, Graham, that as I wrote in May, it's time for IMSA to separate championship structures for DPI and the WEC P2s, the privateer P2s. I'd also heard you and I spoke about, right after that as well, that we'd heard that that was actually something in motion and was going to happen for next year. Haven't had any official confirmation on that yet, but I'll just say this, and this isn't necessarily a negative in any way about what's been happening with the WEC P2s. I think the bigger question that's going to start coming up, Doug, if it hasn't already been coming up and hasn't been, you know, shouted many times, is this combined DPI slash P2 structure that IMSA brought to fore in 2017 was done with the possibility of WEC P2s winning. So all the DPI manufacturers at that stage, there were three, knew going in that IMSA was going to try and balance these different prototype philosophies on the fastest WEC P2 model. So that was going to be the standard that the DPIs would be adjusted up or down to meet. We know that other than the one win last season, DPIs ran amok. We know that this season, until Watkins Glen, DPIs ran amok. We now have two races at the two tracks with the type that you mentioned, smooth, flowing, high speed, that the WEC P2s have shown their competitiveness. Well, that competitiveness has come from dialing back the DPIs more and more and more. The question, Graham, that I know the DPI manufacturers are raising with IMSA, and I think will end up being the big driver behind the possibility of going to separate championship structures for the two types of cars, is it's hard for an Acura, a Cadillac, and a Mazda. I wouldn't say Nissan so much, because again, that is commissioned directly by the team compared to an outright factory program. But it's going to get increasingly hard for Mazda, Cadillac, and Acura with their factory teams to answer to their CEOs and chief financial officers and chief marketing officers. Wait, we're spending how much as a manufacturer and we're getting beaten by independent teams? I think that, Doug, is going to be the major sticking point that drives these separate class structures, and that's part of what I wrote about in May. Not saying the DPIs and the manufacturers are better than the privateers, not at all. But if we look at the amount of money being invested, and the, I believe, even though they knew it was possible for WEC P2s to win, I don't think that's ever going to sit well, especially when you lose two races in a row, maybe even three. We see what comes out of Road America. But I think the thing that's going to push IMSA towards having to do separate classes, separate point structures, is the DPI manufacturers, I know, are not going to swallow this for very long. And Graham, I think the point for you to take is, if you're going to ask for 8-figure budgets each year, eventually someone's going to start pushing back when it looks like you're being beaten by amateurs, or the winning manufacturer on the weekend is, quote, Gibson or Areca or Liger, which no one has heard of. That's hard to justify internally on a regular basis.
It is, and you know, if it is the part of the double-edged sword that is having manufacturers involved with any series, isn't it? Which is that, you know, pretty quickly they're not going to be very pleased if a privateer team is going to be winning on a regular basis against them. I do have a point of view that, you know, they knew coming into this that was the intention, and need to show some patience and sportsmanship around this one, but it certainly is not going to stop them from putting in the public affairs hours of trying to persuade the powers that be in this championship that now is the time, if you've got the aspiration to make this the world-class sports car championship that it most clearly is, you need to reflect that by looking after your major stakeholders rather than your customers. And that's the difference between a factory effort with the activation that comes with it, the investment in the marketing around the series, the TV package, etc., and a customer, which is generally speaking what you'll find from most of the privateer LMP2 teams.
Should mention here that you are listening to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires. We are supported this month, thankfully, by our friends at Justice brothers, a long time friend of mine, and very thankful to them, Graham, for them coming on board. And if you are indeed interested either in their products, their array of additive lubricants and cleaners, or you are interested from a business standpoint of possibly developing a sales and distribution model for yourself at home to make some money, their line of automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial products can all be viewed, and the sales and distribution angle explored on justicebrothers.com. One more here on Facebook before you take the reins on Twitter, and that is specifically for you from Adam Smith. Adam asked this of myself and Lee Diffie on the IndyCar podcast. Said, I want to hear Graham Goodwin's take. If Quentin Tarantino contacted you to make a movie about your career in motorsports, which actor plays your character?
Ooh. Well, I mean, rather bizarrely, I did over the weekend meet for the very first time someone else called Graham Goodwin. And it just so happens that the other Graham Goodwin is a racing driver, owns a couple of very beautiful 1920s, 1930s sports cars, and finished in the top 10 a couple of the races over the weekend. A fellow Graham Goodwin, another Brit. Who would play Graham Goodwin? Have to have that kind of geeky appeal, you know, my rugged good looks, the kind of, you know, the simmering malcontent that I am. Stephen Merchant.
He would have to kneel, unfortunately, to play that role. And hey, while we're speaking, Colin Brown is calling. So I will have to let the dear lad text him here. We'll ring you right back. Okay. Look at that. Call declined on Colin Brown. You know why?
You're more important. We'll look back in a couple of years, you know, when he's won the Indy 500 twice, and you look back and regret that that call, Carl. You know that, don't you?
It's breaking exclusive scoop news. I know that he was going to share. All right, brother, it is your turn to take the reins on Twitter.
Well, first one comes from Benny Reese. Ben Reese, any news on what happened to the 1969 Porsche 917? Derek Bell, originally down to drive at the Le Mans Classic, was hoping to see it. Couldn't spot it during the race feeds. Good reason for that. This is the car that I'm afraid was involved in a fatal accident in 1969. Long tail car. Beautiful piece of kit. John Wolfe fatally injured in the car, controversially rebuilt by on the orders of its owner, Willie Cowson, the original development driver for the Porsche 917, and under the tutelage of none other than Norbert Singer. I'm afraid the car had a very big accident indeed out on the track and ended up in two pieces. Luckily, the driver in one piece. But do have to ask the question whether or not that might be a bit of a message that the gods of motorsport really didn't want that car to come back. I was lucky enough to see it in one piece. It was a thing of magnificence, but apparently a very scary beast indeed. Right turn lover. My next one, hello, my Swiss friend. As far as I know, there are rumours of ESM's Ed Brown to do some GTD racing. Any news on that? And as there'll be much celebration over beautiful old sports cars, what was the ugliest sports racing car ever? I am the least likely journalist on the planet for Ed Brown to share the details of his forthcoming programs with. Ed was not happy that I broke with Delhi Sports Car the news about the ESM DPI program with the Nissan engine, and made that very clear to me very loudly in the Austin press room.
I recall that. I recall wondering why there was what sounded like shouting.
It didn't just sound like shouting. It was shouting. Yeah. Never mind. I've moved on with my life. As for you may or may not know whether or not there's plans for GTD. I certainly don't, MP.
No, I have a call into Scott Sharp that I need to follow up on when we're done here. So we might have some post-episode news.
Excellent. But beyond that, the ugliest sports car ever. One of the ugliest sports cars ever was another one that was at Le Mans over the weekend, and it's the 1950 Cadillac, the Monstre Cadillac. Two very different looking cars fielded by the factory team back then. The Monstre, as it was called, for good reason, a very blunt instrument indeed, streamlined as only a 1950s car could be, And whilst it is utterly magnificent, I think it was Jordan Taylor actually drove it, didn't he, at Daytona fairly recently. But I happen to think it's one of the most horrendous looking things on the planet. Don't know about you, MP.
Yeah, and I feel bad because it's pulling from a playbook that is almost completely worn through. I still firmly believe, and granted, I say that because there's so many of the original, the early Daytona prototypes that are just continue to be a visual affront to humanity. A lot of folks point to the Piquio as being the ugliest ever. I don't think it, for me at least, it wasn't as ugly. I'm not saying it wasn't ugly, but it wasn't the worst. I actually thought it had a little bit of bodywork styling involved. The Doran JE5 or whatever it was, that thing was definitely a punch to the old eyeballs. But I would say, for me, probably the worst, because it just had so many lines that did not fit. It looked like, when it was white, the white number 88, it looked like a melted marshmallow. And that was the Multimatic DP, which I think they tried to call a Ford or something like that. The Ford Focus. I mean, brother, even if it's ugly, if you can at least look at it and say, okay, whomever penned this understood that the lines towards the front should somehow intersect in a vaguely agreeable way with the ones in the side going to the back. This was like they asked seven people to design the bodywork, gave them little areas, yep, and never allowed them to see what the rest were working on.
I do actually know, MP, the story behind the design of this car.
Share
I
it.
Do know. No, it's. I think it's a fantastic thing that Multimatic and Ford actually got into. It was a local promotion. They got a kindergarten class to design the car, and then the winning. It is awful, isn't it? It does look like a train wreck. I'm going to give you another one, and it's another one that's relevant to the past weekend, and it's one that we've talked about on the show before, which I saw rolling pretty quickly and loudly for the very first time, and that was the Chevy Cannibal was
at Le Mans this weekend.
Very, very few of the cars at Le Mans in that Global Endurance Legends that I've not had the pleasure of writing about directly or indeed commentating on. But the Chevy Cannibal was there, and I stood quite close to the car as parents shielded their children's eyes from it. And there were various comments of, what the hell is that, in French?
That's not even an ugly car, though. You have to understand the context. That car was an extra from the Mad Max movie set, okay, that they took to a racetrack. So, you know, this was never even designed for beauty. It was actually designed for offense. So, I mean, in that standard, they've won clearly by many, many miles. All right.
Right. The next one is from Tom Welfler. At Dyson fan, and it's worse things to be a fan of than that particular brand of vacuum cleaner. Love the show, guys. Quickly became my number one sports car podcast. If our favorite team from Wisconsin, I mean Minnesota, were to go the way of the Hyundai DPI next year, what motor would like to be utilized? Thanks, gents. Well, I actually asked you this question, because I think the question I asked you was, do they plan to use a derivative of the WRC engine for Hyundai? And you said,
I don't think so, but maybe. Or did I say that? I don't, brother. I don't. What is this we're doing here? I'm not sure.
There's a variety of options available, and I think the answer will come not from, you know, effectively, let's do this or let's do that. I think they'll be looking at exactly what how things are panning out with the various, and there are various options currently performing in DPI. And you know what? It's a little bit like what happened with the LMP1 hybrids. We started out with three very different solutions. We ended up with them coming together because actually that's the way the development curve took them. And it may very well be that if Hyundai does actually happen for our good friends with the JDC Miller team, that the the motor choice they make might be informed by the success of another manufacturer's motor in a different DPI. Let's wait and see for that one.
Yeah, and let me fill in a couple items here as we start to wind down, actually pretty quickly because we need to get you headed towards the airport. I believe we mentioned this last week, but it's worth repeating again. The Hyundai interest is from the team, not the manufacturer, in the same exact way that Tequila Patron ESM pursued and then ultimately contracted Nissan and their chassis supplier Liger to do bespoke bodywork and to place engines in the back of their Nissan Onroad DPIs. I have to thank many, not all, but many of the commenters on that story on racer.com. Some of the funniest things I've read in a long time. There are a couple of folks, which was great, Graham. And this is just the beauty of the internet. Someone started off with just this long rant and then posted many calling me out as essentially being a charlatan presenting these fake scenarios or whatever thinly acceptable possibilities of what might happen, even though 50% of the article was quotes from Bob Stallings telling me this is exactly what he wanted to do. And one person, which was great, one person, again, was saying this is shoddy journalism. I hate this kind of stuff. It's all innuendo and select choice of usage of quotes. And basically just rip the article to shreds, which, again, that's what comment sections are for. Then took the exact thing I wrote about this being just what I mentioned, not a manufacturer interest, but the team pursuing the manufacturer to do this, something which Bob Stallings already done once with Hyundai in PwC, and presented what I think, you know, the most likely scenario is the team would contract blah, blah, blah. And I'm reading that saying, so you've just called out everything I've written as shoddy journalism and garbage, etc. And then you repeat exactly what I wrote as your own thoughts on what might happen. Now that's awesome. So either we're both shoddy or anyways, but it was pretty hilarious.
Isn't the internet wonderful?
Oh, I love it. But reading through it. So again, I just mentioned and reiterate this. The Hyundai interest is from Bob Stallings and John Miller, the two people putting the primary funding into the team in going after Hyundai. This is something Bob's already done once, so it's not as if this is a crazy concept of theirs. Bob did mention that there's a 3.3 liter twin turbo V6 that might be perfect, which I think, to answer the question, that's where this whole thing came from. If you look at the fact that we have a 3.8 liter twin turbo V6 from Nissan out of their GTR, currently having a lot of problems with that program, and also a 3.5 liter twin turbo V6 from Honda / Acura. I think this is kind of the magic formula we've seen where you might want to fall in DPI. Other thing, which again, I think we might've mentioned last week, but I'll just throw this in to close this loop, Graham. I don't know if I would paint this as their number one option or priority. Bob Stallings in the interview that we did, and I'll just mention this because it might be interesting. I didn't actually bring this up or know about it. I was calling Bob to get a reaction to the very first win for a Red Dragon prototype in quite some time, which he kindly did, and that story went up. And he said, oh, by the way, and then cracked open the door on this whole topic here. It was kind of big enough and surprising enough to where I called the team's PR rep and said, hey, Bob just told me all these things. A, is this like top secret, or the things he told me accurate? Confirmed all is accurate. Confirmed with one other person too, so that's why the story went up. But all that stuff aside, in the story, Graham, which I didn't push too hard on, but folks might be worth considering, he did mention, which was a little bit ill-fitting out of nowhere, that he has a long-standing allegiance with General Motors. So I would say that I don't know if I would place Bob Stallings' Hyundai aspirations atop their priorities. I would say it's, you know, towards the top. But if that team were to turn up next year in Cadillac DPIs, that to me would actually be the least shocking thing. So just a little bit of things to clean up or add to what we spoke about last week.
I'll push on with a couple more to finish what we'll do with Twitter for this time around. They're sort of interlinked, so I'll run them both together. One's from Max Radker and the other one from Aaron Sera. Thanks, guys, for writing in. Max asks, over the course of an endurance race, what changes are made to the car to keep up with changing conditions? Also, do drivers have tools like an IndyCar with the ability to adjust anti-roll bars, etc.? Thanks for our excellent coverage. Aaron, meanwhile, says, at the peak of LMP1H, we had three manufacturers, each with their own solution to the same technical problem. On a deja vu moment here, what do you think is the next such problem where freedom in regulations could result in similar diversity of approaches that can be raced and proven on the track? I'll go with the second one first. That's going to be zero emissions, no doubt for me whatsoever, that as and when that comes forward. At the moment, that's predicted by ACO World as being the 2024 regulations. That will be the moment when we're going to have manufacturers coming forward with then maturing technology, whether or not they can make it in 24 or later, with different ideas to that same question. Hydrogen fuel cell appears to be at the moment the favourite, but who knows what else might actually come out. That, for me, will be the next major step. As for over the course of an endurance race, what changes are made to the car? Depends on the car, is the honest answer. I'll give you two answers from my non-technical point of view before I hand over to the man who knows a lot more technically than I do. Two things from recent experience. One was a conversation with Alex Wurz, start of the season, explaining how he was transitioning back into the TSO50, which he tested at the Prologue, and the first time he'd been aboard a Tota for something over a year. And he was explaining that every 2 to 3 corners in an endurance race, those guys will be making 2 to 4 significant adjustments about the various systems and settings in the car in terms of how the power is delivered, brake balance, etc., etc. Significant adjustments, multiple adjustments during a lap, not a race, a lap. And I asked him what difference that would make. He said, look, the cars can default to an automatic setting. That will cost you somewhere like 2 seconds a lap. So it's all about not just the driver's superhuman powers behind the wheel, but also their acuity, the mental acuity, and their ability to deal with that feedback that they're getting from the feel of the car, I'm sure for the engineers on the radio, and make the significant adjustments which will make the difference all the way through. The second one I'll give you is some work I did at Watkins Glen with young Phil Hansen from the United Autosports team, who walked us around their Ligier JSP 217 Gibson, took us through a little bit about the aero, but in particular the cockpit, and in very much in particular the steering wheel and the various settings on that steering wheel that the drivers have available to them, other than to actually point in the direction of what Phil actually had to say. Remember, Phil, an emerging talent, but not yet a top professional driver, not a million miles away from it. But you get an opportunity with that little film. You'll find it on DSC's YouTube channel and on United Autosports as well, I believe. Have a look at that and you'll see what, even in an LMP2 car, the drivers have available to them, should they and their engineering staff wish to take that opportunity.
Yeah, and to answer briefly, because I don't want to take away, please do go visit that and lend some views there. If you're talking prototypes, we're talking more options for in-cockpit tuning and adjustment. Not maybe a crazy amount, but below LMP1. We get into GT, that is really where you don't have a ton. And I would say, I'm not sure why that's the case, but I would say that that has been a prevailing mindset of not giving drivers too many things to push, pull, twist, or whatever to tune the car while in competition. So not sure I'm a fan of that, but that happens to be where prevailing mindset has taken things. Well, Graham, let me grab one or just a couple of quick items left, and then let's get you on the way to pick up Mrs. Goodwin. I got two fun things here from our friend in Australia, David Zitterbart. I was wanting to just share an appreciation, and this is part of the asking you all to just, you know, Doesn't always have to be questions. Sometimes just share your thoughts with us. Wanted to talk about his appreciation and try and lend some context of what Craig Lowndes has meant to those like himself from down under. He said his retirement announcement has been a big thing in Australia. Said Craig's been a household name since 1994, the Bathurst 1000 then for all Holden fans. On top of which, I'm fairly sure he would be the most recognized athlete within Australia, even more than Mark Webber or Daniel Ricciardo. And he said to draw parallels from F1, Craig retiring from supercars is the equivalent of Michael Schumacher leaving F1. And so that, again, I thought was a brilliant explanation there. And then also had a fun question from David asking, how often has Mrs. Pruitt walked out to the garage and found me beneath a race car making some sort of tune or adjustment? It's been a while, actually. It's been quite some time. And when we met, I was still actively involved on the weekends in racing, and she put up with a lot of too much time with me being gone, but has also been incredibly helpful, David. There were times during my first ever 25 Hours of Thunderhill when I ran my own team, not someone else's team, where we had a bunch of great drivers, and she always tells a story about preparing a nice big serving of lasagna and how Tanner Faust basically ate damn near all of it. And yet Bob Varsha was incredibly complimentary of it and such. But yeah, Mrs. Pruitt has been honestly, and this is without being maudlin, but she has been the power and support and a source of energy for me to do what I do. John Sable, we touched on this a little bit last week, but I like the way that this was phrased. He said, what's the harm in allowing the IMSA P2 team some allowances on suspension and engine development outside of the WEC regulations? I don't see how allowing them to swap out some parts and settings in IMSA hurts them. When they go to Le Mans, in theory, they would have to then abide by those regulations and change back. Said IMSA did a good job with BOP at Mossport, but I still want to see the leash taken off the DPIs and reward teams that put the development in. Completely agree with the last part, John. I mean, the reality is, the answer is, IMSA made an agreement that they would not crack open anything on the WEC P2s to allow WeatherTech Championship teams stray from the FIA and ACO's global spec. So I would say until the term of limits on this formula is over, that is probably what they are going to stick with. And I'll pick one more here to close, Graham. And I'm not exactly sure. You know, James Counter, good on you. In light of all the record-breaking runs, so referring to Neil Johnny at Spa in the Porsche 919 Evo, Timo Bernhard recently at the Nürburgring in the same car, and then also Romain Dumas at Pikes Peak. James says, in light of all those record-breaking runs, which driver do you think has the largest metaphorical balls? All right, Graham, who are you picking?
I think Romain Dumas is the world's best type of madness. There was a theory, and it's a strong theory, that Timo Bernhard was picked for the Nürburgring efforts because of two things. One is he knows the track. Two is that he wouldn't have overdriven it for that last tenth, and fingers were being pointed in the direction of perhaps some other Porsche factory drivers that likely would have gone rather quicker and or ended up somewhere in the trees towards Belgium.
They'd still be looking in that for car. Them, yes.
Yes, indeed. Yes, and I'm not going to name names, Nick Tandy, but the reality is that they chose the right man for that job. He did what was required. Who do I think is the true nutter out there, the one who's just that little bit? There are a number out there who are just otherworldly special. I think Dumas has an extraordinary talent to be able to step into and out of cars that are just so different and squeeze the very best out of them. We're going to be seeing the 919 tributes at Laguna Seca, of course, for Rennsport Reunion. We're going to be seeing the IDR trying to break the electric record at Goodwood Festival of Speed. I don't think we've seen the last of these kind of efforts. I think that's a very good thing. I've just come back, Martian, as you quite rightly said at the top of the show, from what was nothing less than a three-day celebration of the car and all that is good about it. It was an event of passion, and that's what I want out of motorsport, whether or not that's somebody pushing for one of the grand races in IMSA or in the world of the ACO, or just a group of individuals, some on the technical side and usually one on the driving side, pushing the envelope. That to me is what it's all about. It stands, I think, you know, shoulder to shoulder, what we've seen with the 919 hybrid, the tribute car, and the IDR at Pikes Peak, stands shoulder to shoulder with the likes of the Thrust SSC program, with the likes of the Blue Flame, with Sir Malcolm Campbell as just, human endeavor looking to smash through a ceiling that people thought couldn't be broken. Let's have more of it.
And I'll just add this in to close. I also love the fact, Graham, knowing that Timo Bernhard and Romain Dumas were teammates for many years, champions in sports cars. I love the fact that while representing the same Volkswagen Audi group family, these two friends, close teammates, winners of just everything imaginable together, one took the new outright lap record at the Nürburgring. The other took a new outright record on the Pikes Peak Hill climb. So here are these two close friends, champions and teammates, setting two international records just within a matter of days of each other. One in the craziest hybrid petrol-fueled type vehicle, another one all electric. I think it's pretty cool just for these two friends to achieve such things while under the VAG banner. My friend, you have a wife to go bring home, and we need to say thank you, as always, to you, the listener, for being awesome and supporting what we do here. Don't want to be too cheeky, but if you do happen to like what you hear, please share it, because we're trying to grow it. If you have friends who are into sports cars, we would not be ashamed if you let them know that we exist. So with all that said, for Graham Goodwin, I am Marshall Pruitt. This is the Week in Sports Cars, supported by our friends at Cooper Tires, and also this month from the Justice Brothers. We will speak to you next week.